Welcome, everyone, to the eighth installment of the Mentality Monsters podcast. This week, Fedja and I were batting around some ideas around the concept of having a big bucket of wants in your life versus having a big bucket of needs. And as we typically do on this podcast, we look at that concept, wants versus needs, through the lens of sports, some of our favorite athletes and teams presently, some of our favorite athletes and teams historically, and see how they were able to balance these two concepts and how that presented itself in their results.
I wanted to talk about this because I was noodling around with our ideas of who we are and what we advocate for and what we believe. And we talk a lot about being stress resilient and satisfied men, and that satisfaction equals liking minus wanting. And the other day I was listening to a podcast and the guest on the podcast was talking about wanting versus needing. And so I was reflecting on our idea of liking minus wanting versus someone else framing it as wanting versus needing. And as you and I were talking about right before we started recording, the liking minus wanting is a process-oriented idea where when you like the process, you free yourself from the outcomes that you want. And so you begin to create success by creating these systems that support those wants without solely focusing on the want itself. The wanting versus needing element of this conversation is how you understand which outcomes you're creating those processes for. Are you doing things because you purely want to do them, or are you doing them because some external force is causing you to need to do them?
Yeah, I think on the road to self-mastery, there's a really interesting TED Talk I saw on YouTube one time. Referenced it in an earlier episode. There's a Qigong master who speaks about this, and one of the hindrances to self-mastery is gluttony, which, you know, gluttony is typically associated with wanting to eat too much. And that comes into play too when we crave the results of what we're doing too much, when we get too overly ambitious, perhaps even dramatic with, you know, what we want to achieve, you know, in the short term, right? And we pile too much on ourselves. So when you're climbing a tall mountain, really all you're focused on is the next pass, the next, you know, little hump to overcome, what you have to do that day. So I'm a big believer in the importance of focusing on the process. And I believe a lot of masterful coaches historically in some of my favorite sports are also a hallmark of their success is a drilling of the process.
How many times have you seen Nick Saban viciously yell at his players when they're up 50-3 against some inferior team because they messed up a play or were offsides or had a false start or something along those lines?
Well, I also see Saban viciously yell at the media when they ask him questions about being the number one ranked team because he doesn't want his team to look at that or pay attention to that in any way. He only wants them to focus on whatever the next step is, you know, whatever the next game is, the next play. And if they start buying into that too much, it can affect the performance of the team. So I also see him taking issue with the media presenting this really whoever is the number one ranked team is just someone's opinion at that time. They haven't achieved anything. So they're presenting this to him like it's a result that they've achieved and they've not achieved anything. And so he's protecting his team against buying in to what people think about them.
And I'll never miss an opportunity to remind everyone I know that Belichick, Saban, Christian Pulisic, all Croatian.
Yeah.
You're welcome, America.
I was surprised I made it to the eighth episode without him bringing that up before, to be completely honest with you.
Okay, so I kicked it off by talking about like how this idea, it relates to our belief in the process or, and so the concept can help us choose which outcomes we want. we want to achieve. Because when we are driven by needs-based outcomes, so when we're told we need to get a girlfriend, we need to get a better job, when we say things like, I need to start a diet, you're being motivated and controlled by external forces that you can't directly control. And this is what oftentimes makes us feel like we don't have a sense of direction or purpose in our actions. So getting to that state of wanting is really important when we're choosing how we want to frame our lives. And the thing that Kyle said that's interesting to me is his analogy about climbing a mountain where you focus on the next step or the next immediate pass. One of the trappings that people fall into very commonly is that they overestimate what they can do in a year and underestimate what they can do in 10 years. And they pile on things in the short term that force us into a corner and back ourselves up into a needs-based approach versus a wants-based approach, where we're taking what we want to achieve, breaking it down into smaller components, and addressing those smaller components little by little, all in a state of wanting, which is a state of internal motivation that allows us to be more consistent with our process and ultimately results in the outcomes that we want.
Yeah, I think as well, you'll see someone with a long list of needs having a nervous system that's in overdrive. Like when you're thinking about climbing the whole mountain in a day, it's very apparent to people who you're talking to, because you feel like you have so many things you need to do. And we've all met someone like that. And that compromises our ability to get things done. Central to successfully achieving stress resilience, which is something we've discussed in depth on the show, is having a healthy relationship with our inner voice. And I believe a hallmark of a healthy inner voice is accuracy. So are we telling ourselves things about ourselves or the world at large which are accurate? Or are we using judgments? Perfect example. An accurate statement would be to say that we lost the game 17-10. An inaccurate statement or a judgment would be to say we lost 17-10 because these two or three players suck, they failed to perform. Sure, you know, while that may be true, there are judgments that are necessary to make at times. But all too often, we find ourselves exaggerating and creating unnecessary. One of the reasons we love sports, because there is a singular truth and a final score. In combat sports, they say never leave it to the judges. So a hallmark of an overly dramatic, draining, and stress-laden personal narrative is an over-reliance on the word need. It's stress-inducing, and it also includes an obsessive focus on what's not happening, what we're not accomplishing, what we don't have, as well as soft language, like what we might do. So when you have an over-reliance on the word need, you'll find yourself, as Vedra said earlier, making statements like, you need a vacation, your team needs a win this week, you really need to start working out more. Well, really, if you were to say you need air to breathe and a roof over your head, one of these statements is accurate, and a bunch of those other statements are overstatements. And this is how we create confusion for ourselves. So I'm excited to jump into some poignant sports examples where you can see teams who are uptight, overly stressed out, and you can tell in the locker rooms and the way the teams perform, because they've got a big list of things they need to do on the field or on the court or on the pitch in order to get a successful result. The great teams are able to have a way they prefer to play, have a way they want to play, and also not need to play that way to get a result.
I have a good example of this that's not based on a specific team. It's based more on how the game should flow. So if you talk to any basketball fan, I'm a sucker for this too. anytime you see a team complete a one of those like do 20 passes before shooting plays, like plays where you see players just like constantly moving the ball really quickly, attacking the defense by passing and not ball hogging or you know, overcoming the defense through sheer athleticism or skill. That's a type of play that every basketball enthusiast loves because it's talked about in this way. It's like pure basketball or how basketball is meant to be played. And so when I was thinking about examples of teams or how this needs versus wants manifests in sports, this was a really interesting thought that I had that I liked, because in my mind, when you see those plays where the players are working as a team to achieve a shared goal or you know, there's no ego in those plays where they're completing those 20 passes because every player is just finding the perfect opportunity for a scoring play. When you watch these plays, it feels like the players are in this state of flow and like they're not even thinking. They're just moving physically, reacting physically to what the defense is giving them and moving the ball in a way that feels natural and pure, all going where it wants to go. It's not constrained by any external pressures or motivations or expectations. It's just going where it's the best for it to go to get the best possible shot. And I started thinking about moments where this happens. And when you look back on like someone like Michael Jordan's career, oftentimes you hear people talk about his passes to Paxton in 1990, like this alpha male that was supposed to take the last shot, but he gave it away because it was a better play for the team because that's where the ball wanted to go. When you contrast this with like the classic buzzer beater, where one player who dominates the game and is like, you know, the guy, someone like LeBron or Kobe or Steph Curry, Kevin Durant, when they're given the ball in these moments, it's expected of them that they're going to take that shot. Like the team knows it, the coach knows it, the media knows it, the fans know it. Like this is a purely needs-based play. And the reason I love this example so much is because how many times have you seen this situation play out late in a basketball game where like the star player will get the ball because they need to get the ball, it's expected of them. And they actually take a shot that is a terrible basketball shot. So even though the situation is you know, high stakes, high, especially if it's in a championship situation, you put yourself in this position where you're more likely to fail because of all the expectations that surround you than you are to succeed. And yeah, sometimes we do succeed, and sometimes we you know, what's his face, Kyrie Irving shot against the it was a late game shot against the Warriors that won the Cleveland Cavaliers the championship. We love those moments, Michael Jordan's buzzer beaters, but they don't happen often. And when you compare the success of that needs-based play to the success of that wants-based play where the players are moving around and sharing, it's dramatically different. Like you have super high rates of success because the ball is going where it wants to go versus what's the thing that Michael Jordan always says? He missed way more buzzer beaters than he took. And we always focus on his willingness to take those shots and how courageous that is, while ignoring the fact that all of those shots he missed were not ideal plays or ideal shots to take because they aren't what's best for the team most of the time. I'd argue that every time one of those buzzer beaters is taken, there's a high likelihood that there's an open player right under the basket or in the corner for a three that would have been a much better opportunity to win the game versus that star player taking that shot.
Yeah, I can attest. Fedra and I used to go to one another's houses, you know, growing up and watch the NBA playoffs. And this guy would be shaking his head whenever a player took one of these shots for like the last 15 years. And it's clear Fedra could not wait for the opportunity to put these people on blast on a public forum on this podcast.
Finally.
Yeah. And you know, it was funny, too, whenever I would go to his house and his dad would be there, too. His dad would also lament these same horrible basketball plays after a long drag on a cigarette and just shake his head and just offer up a singular word that somehow served as a testimony for the last 5 minutes. And you just knew exactly what he meant. Like it would just be like, horrible. Yeah. You would just know what he was talking about without having to go into any sort of detail whatsoever. So,
in a deep Slavic accent.
Yes, exactly. You know, I think hearing the hearing you talk about players, teams forcing a shot made me think about Peyton Manning's subpar performances in the postseason, because so many of his teams were built to win in a singular way. Like, there was a way they needed to play to win the game. It was on offense, Peyton, whether it was first, second, or third down, would be throwing slants and seam routes and the occasional out route to Marvin Harrison and Reggie Wayne and Dallas Clark. And if someone could take that away, the B option, like, that wasn't a preferred way of playing. That was a way they needed to play, doubly so because defensively they had Dwight Freeney and Robert Mathis, who were great pass rushers. So if they didn't have the lead, those players were compromised in what they could deliver for the team. So they would go on these runs in the regular season where they were going against inferior competition. And then when they went up against a team that could drop their ego and say, we're going to sell out to make sure we stop this, they had the talent to do it and the how do I put it, the guile to stick with it for 60 minutes, they would inevitably beat the Colts. And of course, Bill Belichick and the Patriots were one of the teams that could do this with regularity. And I think that Belichick is brilliant at devising schemes that take advantage of teams with a need-based thought process.
He did this to my Browns this past weekend, obliterated them, because the Browns absolutely need to run the ball to set up their offense. And
Belichick will get teams to, he will get his teams to absolutely commit taking that thing away from the team in question. And he's been doing this. Is a hallmark of what he does for now over 30 years. Goes back to when the Giants played the Bills in the Super Bowl. That game plan is in the Pro Football Hall of Fame because he told his players to actually allow Thurman Thomas to run for 100 yards. It's like, the thing that we need to take away is the intermediate passing game from Jim Kelly. And if you can just imagine some of the toughest, most macho guys on earth thinking, we're going to allow a guy to run on us. And I think Belichick's ability to get his players to actually follow through with that is what separates the Patriots from other teams. Because every team's trying to take away the thing you do best, but so few will sell out the way the Patriots do.
It's really incredible how they go about doing it. I mean, you're right. It's not just the fact that you can execute it or you build that plan. Yeah. It's getting the players to believe that that plan is in the best interest for the team.
Yeah, I think it's actually a mischaracterization in the media covering the team to say that they take away another team's best thing. No, they take away the thing the other team needs to do to win. Teams with a more flexible scheme who possess multiple ways of going about winning a game based on proper matchup, those teams can beat the Patriots. Because while they may have a way they want to play, they may have a preferred way to play, they're open to other approaches as well. And the Dolphins recently fell into an odd cycle of needing a new quarterback, and all of the promise of what they were building as a roster has fallen apart. You feel no positive energy around that team, because rather than saying we want, you know, we chose Tua, we want him, they fell into this, well, we need to improve that position, and it totally changed the energy of the team. And Belichick, and as you alluded to, Saban are aces at protecting the wants-based culture. Even Mike Tomlin talked about this recently. He said, you know, they released Melvin Ingram from the team. And he said, you know, we want, he said, this was a team first move. even though the player had asked for his release. And the reason it was a team first move was that we want volunteers, not prisoners. We want people who want to be here, not people who need to be here.
Tomlin has a way of contextualizing these things that is unique and entertaining and poignant,
truly,
all at the same time.
Yeah, no, he's great at sales, and I think it's underrated in sports. I mean, Saban is obviously great at sales. It's his greatest skill, well above game planning. I think Sean McVay is great at sales as well. You know, he can get players to want to come there. Odell Beckham had options as to where he could sign when he became a free agent. And very few coaches can call him up and say, yeah, Robert Woods, he was average when he was in Buffalo, but he came here and look what he's doing. You know, he can run down the list of players where it's like, yep, look what they did elsewhere, but look what I did with them. And if you want to be a part of that, great.
The importance of selling, especially in professional sports, is magnified by a million, because all of these athletes, they're professional athletes. They know how to play the game. They know what they need to do to be successful. There's only so many things you can do with an offensive or a defensive scheme. I mean, when you look at the most innovative football NFL schemes, it's not completely revolutionary stuff. It's tweaks or additions to fundamental aspects of the game. I mean, even in soccer too, like, you're making minor adjustments to proven tactics. And so you're right. The difference is in a coach's ability to get that buy-in from their players and make them, like you said, believe that they want to do these things that are minor tweaks or minor differences, because those are the things that are going to make all the difference.
So, great transition here. Pep Guardiola, current manager of Manchester City, he's someone who presided over Barcelona during their most productive era in history and the history of any soccer club around the world. He had a mastery over preference versus need, you know, want versus need. So there is a way, stylistically speaking, for the teams that he's managed that they prefer to play. And it's clear the players share an understanding of this as a matter of preference rather than need. And a perfect example of the sales angle is, I recently saw an interview with Thierry Henry, famous French player who made his name with Arsenal before moving to Barcelona while Guardiola was there. And Henry was an attacker. He had to be sold on the idea of immediately running to win the ball back from his opponent when he lost it. And Guardiola told him that if he had put a shift in and run really hard as soon as he lost the ball to get it back immediately, when he recovered the ball, he would already be in an attacking area of the field and he would never need to run to the other end. So Henry understood this immediately and began playing within the scheme, and it became something he wanted to do versus something he thought the coach needed him to do. And this is how you get buy-in from players on a philosophy and buy-in from yourself to commit to things. When you can articulate why you want something and the framing of it detaches you from needing it to go that way, anyone who's experienced a successful courtship with a partner understands how this works. You want each other. You don't need each other. And I think we've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about the how, which is important for the how is more practical for a mass of people. But for the individual, the why is always more important.
The fascinating thing about these coaches and these players, why this relationship is so important to dissect, A, because it's relevant and relatable. It's easy to convey these concepts through these relationships that we all know. It's everyone has effectively like a coach and a player within themselves. And so a lot of these conversations that Connor and I are having about how the coach motivates the players and how they get the players to buy in and how it's a relationship between the two that goes both ways, this is effectively how you have to do things in your own mind as you're determining what you want and how you're going to go about getting it. Like, you have to sell yourself. And Kyle talked about the framing of things. Framing is so important. It helps us understand, for example, when obstacles are opportunities to learn. It helps us understand the why behind what we're doing or how we're doing it. That helps keep us internally motivated to stay consistent and move in the direction we want to go. All of those things are critical to creating the outcomes that you want.
And I would say a phrase that keeps popping into my mind this week is discipline equals freedom. So when you set up boundaries for yourself and you set up discipline for yourself, you give yourself fewer things to back away from in your life. And so when you simplify the set of things that you are doing in a day and who you are, if you become uncomfortable with that, then you know to eliminate it. And by process of elimination, you start to move closer to the things that you love. Hey, I simplified my life. I've put it all into X. Didn't love it. Now I'm on to the next thing. This is the process of developing not only an identity that you want. We're starting to see the connection here. We're starting to see the connection between a lot of the things that, you know, we've talked about. These teams, all the teams we've talked about who are great at playing how they want, they have a strong identity. They have strong habits. And these are all things, the snowball starting to build.
I did this personally when I reframed how I view my day in terms of fulfillment and my values. So I went to school to be an engineer. I love data. I love tracking things. I created an Excel spreadsheet that I use to track my tasks during the day and my finances, you know, the books I read, different things like that. Previously, I had been tracking activities like outcomes-based stuff, and I was struggling to stick to those habits that I wanted to exercise because there wasn't anything internally motivating me to do what I was doing. And so I reframed that sheet in terms of my values and the idea of fulfillment. And fundamentally, what that did was it dug into the why behind the things that I want to do. And it gave me the flexibility to base things off of wants rather than needs. So when I was tracking activities and outcomes, I was tracking the things I thought that I needed to do in a day to be successful. Now I'm tracking the things that I want to do in a day to be successful. And the reason this approach has worked so well for me is because looking at things in terms of fulfillment is an overly simplified way of thinking about your day. Hey, I value this specific thing. I value a connection to family. So I can accomplish that in 5 or 6 different ways. I can call my parents. I can give my fiance, you know, a nice little card. All of those different things that I can do are things that I want to do to fulfill that fundamental value, which makes me more present and happier in that moment. So the idea of simplification and understanding the why is having a solid understanding of that makes it way easier to be disciplined and to get that freedom that Kyle was talking about.
Yeah, I also think that we exist in the context of other people and we exist, you know, socially. So the idea of, well, you know, don't care what other people think, I believe when you simplify your life and you're engaging in the habits that you love and that you enjoy, you become easier for people to wrap their arms around because there's less about you that they want to back away from. And so when you notice this in action, there's a healthy flip side to caring what other people think, because you'll notice that people gravitate to you more when you are living a more simplified life and leaning into the things that you love. And it's so rewarding because relationships are the reason that we're alive, in my belief. And a lot of these characters that we've talked about, like a Belichick or a Saban or a Guardiola, are relatively ruthless in establishing the habits, the identity, the process, because the joy exists on the flip side of that. When you can play those schemes, win every week, that is where you get the joy. There was a scene in the book Das Reboot, where it was the first time I read about or heard about Pep Guardiola. The book was about how the German national team rebuilt their program to win the 2014 World Cup. And Guardiola at the time was, at the time of this scene in the book, he was still coaching Barcelona. He went to a team in Germany after that, Bayern Munich. And Italy was one of the teams that vexed Germany, and they had a player named Andrea Pirlo that Guardiola wanted. He didn't need on his Barcelona team. He wanted him. So he cornered him in a hotel in the lobby. He invited him down to have a glass of red wine, as the Italians like to do. And he says, look, Andrea, my team is a tourbillon, which is the world's most expensive watch. If you leave a watch in the same place and don't move it at all for 20 years, the gears will lose 1 second of time. But a tourbillon, the gears actually float three-dimensionally to save that 1 second. And he said, my team's a tourbillon. With you, it'll have Rolex batteries. It will never die. And he romanticized in that statement, and he romanticized in that very statement the importance of having such a well-drilled process and identity, because when you do have that, you can have something, a result as beautiful as that. That man was operating in such a margin to save 1 second over 20 years. That was effectively the margin he was operating in, as well as having a battery in that watch that would ensure that it never died. That was the level he was going to, and he was able to get there and get there with joy because he had the habits, he knew the why, he had the identity. And these are, again, all topics that we're exploring deeply, and we're going to continue to explore with some great personalities from the world of sports and the world of athletics who have achieved. And we think talking with these folks over the next several weeks and months is going to further drive home these important concepts.
Man, talk about selling a vision.
Exactly. Exactly, dude. I mean, yeah, he was just chilling there with the wine. Again, he knows the Italians love it. And Pirlo turned him down, as it would be, because he never played for Barcelona. So
he didn't know what a Toblerone is.
Yeah, exactly.
I want to wrap up with one final callback to the things that we believe in and who we are and what we believe. Right? We believe that we're stress resilient, satisfied men. We believe that satisfaction equals liking minus wanting in the process, and seeking that wanting for the outcome. And we also believe that frustration equals talent minus belief. And the topics that we discussed today are important because the idea of wanting keeps us internally motivated. It's doing for the sake of doing. And it starts from the heart. So we talk about an inside out approach where, you know, we go from, we settle ourselves internally and we express our settled internal state through our actions, the external world. So when you do things, when you're in a wanting state, you start at the heart. That state is reinforced and crystallized in the mind, and it's expressed via our body, which is our actions. This is why this idea of wanting struck a chord with me so much. Being in this state is a very powerful expression of the things both inside of us and outside of us. It's an idea that shows that when we're in that state of wanting, everything we know inside is in perfect alignment with everything that we do outside. And that's something that's fundamental to who we are and what we believe and why we're doing this. And it's worth repeating and hammering home because of how important and life-changing shifting your language and your actions and your approach to these methods of doing can be.
I could simplify the heart piece real easily. Whenever you're confused as to what to do and someone says, what does your heart tell you? It's the most annoying advice in the world, because then there's clearly only one thing to do at that time. So if you follow your heart, you will discover the wanting, the things you want to do, as I just said, and you will discover the joy in the process, and you will discover who you are. The identity and the process are looking for each other. There's what came first, the chicken or the egg? Well, we don't know, but we do know those two things are looking for each other to reinforce one another. And when you have them together, the results are quite beautiful.
Thank you all for listening. Please like, subscribe, leave comments, give us 5 stars. That help us. That helps us broaden our audience. We'll
and tell a friend.
Yeah. We'll see you in the next episode.